Hi, everyone, and we're back to the Neil Haley Show here on the Total Celebrity segment. I'm excited to welcome the program. Again, this is the Caregiver Dave Celebrity segment. Caregiver Dave Nisani. Dave, how are you? I see you're in your studio. Are you surviving in California, my man?
We are not only surviving, Neil, we are thriving here in California.
Oh, yeah, thriving with this coronavirus. It feels like, and since our state has become like Dave's state, it's ridiculous here in Pennsylvania, especially Western Pennsylvania, going into specific places with masks on everywhere. You going to a Sheetz at 1 o'clock in the morning and feel like it's a hospital. That's a crazy experience, Dave.
Yeah.
All right, so Dave, go ahead and introduce our guest.
Jeff Abrahams. He is an agent for comedians. He is a funny guy himself. He has some really big time name people, and I could do like Guilford Godfrey and introduce him for like an hour, but I won't. I will just say he's a great guy. He's got a new book out. The Show Must Not Go On. It's about people who have actually died on stage. And I'm not talking about comedians who have died on stage. Otherwise he wouldn't have room in the book for all the stories. But literally comedians, and not only comedians, but anybody who has actually died on stage, which is an incredible subject. I don't think I personally have ever seen anybody who has actually croaked on stage. So welcome, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Neil. Hi, Dave. How are you? Welcome.
Good.
All right. Yeah.
Let me say the correct title is The Show Won't Go On. Won't Go On.
Won't Go On. Okay. That's better. That's shorter.
The most shocking, bizarre, and historic deaths of performers on stage. And that's all I had written for 12 years. What happened was, about 15 and a half years ago, I went to see an Elvis tribute show. And part of the show was a man named Al DeBoren. The name probably means nothing to you guys, but you know the voice. Ladies and gentlemen, Elvis has left the building.
Elvis has left the building. Yes, I know that.
Well, he had worked with Elvis and the Colonel going back to 1955, and he wound up becoming the announcer, and you hear on the famous Madison Square Garden show. And at the end of this Elvis tribute show, Al was in the lobby mulling around with friends, and someone said, "Al, when are you going to write a book? You've done it all." And he goes, yeah, I know. I'll get to it." And this was, we said goodbye to him at 10 o'clock Sunday morning after having breakfast, leaving the hotel, and he was killed in a car accident.
Yeah. No procrastination. That's right.
And it literally took the breath away. I said, "Wait, I was just with this person less than 12 hours ago."
Wow.
And I thought about other performers who had died going to a show, or, you know, Buddy Holly, you know, when all the plane crashes, Jim Croce, and I knew about, you know, one of the Righteous Brothers, and I even knew a couple of performers who had died on stage, like Dick Shawn, and we'll get to in a second. So I came up with this great title, "The Show Won't Go On," and that's all I had written. And people just, after a while, people said, "Shut up, stop talking about it." except for my writing partner, Bert Kearns, who's an investigative journalist, and a damn good friend, and we had worked together on a previous book about tabloid journalism. He said, "Shut up, let's do it." So we compiled the book, and it was literally going to be all that, the before, the after, the during. And while doing the research, he realized that there were more people that had died on stage that we had never had imagined, and that's how the book came to be.
So, yeah. And wow. Yeah. I think that's fascinating. I think of the person who died on stage because I'm a former professional wrestler. I think of Owen Hart. Right before he was going to perform, you know, he did this act out and then fell and died right before performing. It was that kind of story. And then a lot of wrestlers have died before going to events as well.
Well, Owen is the only athlete in the book. And that's the one thing we wanted to do about the book, is we could have done stuntmen and people who literally would have died, whose career is very risk, risk sensitive, and they would die naturally, like bullfighters and things like that. We could have filled that up easily. So a wrestler is a performer, and the book ends with Carl Wallenda, who's a daredevil, but he's really a performer at the end of the day. So there's a lot of occupations that are not in the book, because otherwise it would have been like the size of a Manhattan phone book. But yes, Owen is a tragic story. He was being lowered into the ring on a wire, and then it collapsed and died instantly in the spring.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, this must be more common than we think, because the term, is there a doctor in the house, right? That has been going on for like thousands of years, but, you know, as long as Shakespeare's been around.
You're absolutely right. If there's any takeaway from my book, I always tell people, if they are going to die on stage, they should never yell, is there a doctor on stage? And the worst occupation to really to be is a comedian, because they will totally think you're doing a new piece of business in your act and you're kidding around. So
yeah,
they won't take you seriously.
Absolutely.
I will give you the best example of, is there a doctor in the house? One of the most famous deaths that no one has seen, but they all know about it, is J.I. Rodale, the health expert, of all people, died during a taping of the Dick Cavett Show.
Oh, my gosh.
During the taping, no one has seen it, but Dick has been talking about it since 1971. And I guess if you had a guy die on your show, you'd be talking about it for the next 40-plus years.
How did it happen?
And so he was this quirky little guy, very funny. He had been profiled in the New York Times a few days before and said he could probably live to 100 with his health regimen. And a lot of people thought he had said that moments before he died. He didn't. Because Bert and I are literally the few people that have ever seen this tape. A friend of mine works for Dick Cavett. He said, if you sell this book, I will allow you to watch this episode. But we got to watch a man literally die on stage. So he does his spiel, and he's very funny, very entertaining.
Comedian.
No, I mean, comedic. He had written plays, but he was just a very quirky kind of guy that would be a great guest on a talk show. So he had finished his segment, moved over one chair, and the next guest was a journalist, Pete Hamill. And as they were talking, you all of a sudden heard what sounded like a snore. And that's where the rumor was. They had always thought that Dick Cavett had said, oh, am I boring you, Mr. Rodale?
Did he say that?
No, it never happened. But within a second, they realized something seriously was wrong.
Oh, my Dick gosh.
Something Dick would have said, yes.
And so Rodale is kind of, you know, with his head back in the chair, and they realize something serious has gone wrong. And Dick is just about to say, is there a doctor in the house? But he realizes if he says that, he will get the laugh from the audience.
Right.
So he stops himself. He says, might there be a doctor here? Might there be a doctor somewhere who can help him? And there was hustle and bustle, and someone trying to bring oxygen out from backstage, and the oxygen tank wasn't working. And next thing you know, he had a heart attack.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh. You know, thinking about that, Dave, I mean, I'm sure that he could write probably 5 volumes of this if he really – this could be just part one of your books, Jeff, in so many ways, Dave. How many – do you have any things that – I know you didn't get the chance to read Jeff's book, but do you think of any instances when a performer died before performing?
I can think of a few instances where a performer should have died. And the first one was Evel Knievel, right? Everyone expected him to die while he's, you know, doing his motorcycle over the Rio Grande or wherever he did. And then there's Houdini, right? These people flirted with death, and we expected them to die. We expected them to not get out of that handcuff thing in the water tank upside down, but somehow they always made it out. And we wouldn't be surprised if they did die.
Well, you make a very good point about Evel Knievel. I mean, these people were performers who had it in their blood. And they probably lost a lot of blood doing what they did, but they loved what they were doing. And they were performers at the end of the day, and the show must go on. You know, he always had to do that bigger jump.
Yeah, and the modern version of him is Steve-O.
Yeah, or Nick Wallenda, who's carrying on the tradition of his grandfather. But you mentioned Houdini. We interviewed Penn Jillette, because we have a whole chapter on a famous magic trick called the bullet catch. And Penn and Teller do that in their live show, and David Blaine did it on the TV special. And he said, we follow the same philosophy that Houdini lived by. We don't do anything more dangerous than sitting in our chair. Even though it looked dangerous, Houdini did take every precaution to show. He really wasn't risking life. Yeah. But he was a showman. But there were moments where he did almost die and things were dangerous.
Yeah. And the closest one, of course, is Siegfried and Roy were there to show with the lions. Absolutely. And he almost did die on stage.
Absolutely. And, you know, Carl Wallenda of the famous Wallenda family, they did a stunt called the Human Pyramid where they had, you know, family members stacked one atop the other walking across the wire. And two members fell to their death and one was paralyzed. And they continued to do that effect. And then after a while, they eventually took it out. And, you know, and Carl Wallenda was literally lived. He said, I would rather die on the wire than in bed. Yeah. And Nick said, no, thank you. I want to die. I want to die in bed with my grandchildren around me. And he, you know, now when he performs his stunts live, I think he just did went over a volcano. He's walked across Times Square. And he's tethered to a line for safety. And, you know, the network insists upon that. But if he had his choice, he would not be tethered. But he said when he's with a family member, he would be tethered just for their safety. And he realizes it gets the same effect. You know, the old days, people used to go to the stock races to see a car crash. But it's not like that anymore. They just want to see that daring test of endurance.
Yeah, people like the no net thing, you know.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And so what did your clients think when they heard you were writing a book, especially about death before going on stage? I'm sure that made you happy. They said, please don't put us in this book, right? We hope to never be in it.
I had, a lot of people said, I hope I'm not in the sequel. You know, when people asked for an autograph, they were very accommodating, and they knew some of the stories, but they were like everyone. They had no idea it had gone back hundreds of years and so many occupations. And probably the one thing they were all shocked to learn, and we were during the research, that the most dangerous occupation was orchestra conductor.
Really? And the orchestra went on, no doubt.
Exactly.
That proves the concept. You do not need a conductor on an orchestra. They know what they're doing. What the heck is the guy there for?
He's just a guy waving his arms, who unfortunately is probably 75 years old or older, living on a life of airplanes and terrible food, exerting himself, not in great health. And while doing that fatal motion, he has a heart attack and he goes.
And he gets upset when they don't call him maestro.
Absolutely.
And he falls down in the pit. You can't.
One of the greatest Seinfeld episodes, Maestro. And he was a community. that was awesome. So now, Jeff, now and the book and all the different things, launching that book for yourself versus launching as a PR publicist for so many major clients, helping them with events, getting, making sure that certain cities have the whole tour. How difficult was it for you to do it for yourself?
Yeah, is it like the guy who says you should never, if you're an attorney, you should never represent yourself, he'll have a fool for a client?
No, it actually really worked to my advantage. You know, I knew every radio host across the country and the producer, the fact that I know you gentlemen because I had booked clients with you. So I was able to call favors and the people who had trusted me that I had given them good clients over the years. And some of them, called and thanked, said they did it as a way of thank you, and people were intrigued by the product. So I certainly knew how to promote a book, and I have represented many authors over the years. So it was very easy to promote this book.
But you had to carve out time, right? Because your clients are going to make you a little bit more money than a book. So that's the other thing.
And when you asked about my clients, I really kind of kept it to a minimum because there was a great TV special in the 80s, I think, called Live in Person. It was hosted by the manager, Sandy Gallen. He was going to try to recreate the Ed Sullivan Show. He was going to host it. It was going to be three live nights in the Shrine Auditorium. And I went to one of the nights. And one of the acts was Menudo. You remember this? They were like the biggest boy band.
Oh, yeah.
And Sigfrid Roy performed, I think I still were. It was either Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton doing Island in the Skies or Neil Diamond and Barbara Streisand. I mean, it was that unbelievable talent. And Joan Rivers was a client of Sandy Gallen. And she called up the office and goes, "Wait, oh, can I talk to Sandy? Oh, he's not here. Oh, where is he? Oh, he's on the set." And she said, "When he gets off the set, would you tell him he's fired? You know, is he managing my career or his career?" So I didn't really let people know until it was done, you know, and I really be very cautious and not posting everything. He said, "Oh, why are you in Vanity Fair and I'm not in Vanity Fair?" You know what I mean?
And that's the thing I have to caution with my clients that are digital marketing. If I'm getting too over in social media, why aren't you doing it for me? You're not spending the time with me. And that's a challenge. It's always a challenge. Now, Jeff, the question, I remember who would you rank as you can't say this, some of the clients you've represented and what you've learned from representing them. Because that's the other thing of growing as a great PR rep is learning from your clients. Can you give an explanation on that process and for people out there listening saying, "I want to be like Jeff someday"?
I represented George Carlin for the last 11 years of his life.
Yeah.
And that was probably one of the greatest joys of my life to represent literally, in my opinion, probably the greatest stand-up comedian. You know, we can have a whole other conversation. You know, there's always a poll, Richard Pryor, George Carlin, George always comes in second. And but Richard is brilliant. I know his daughter. But George, for me, was the best. I grew up with George. And then one day to get a phone call, "How would you like to represent George?" For 11 years, it was amazing. And his work ethic was amazing. And he had a very protective manager of George. And George only wanted to do interviews one day a week rather than driving crazy. "George, you talk to this guy on Tuesday at 11, this guy Wednesday at 3, and, you know." George was doing a new stand-up special every 2.5 years. Can you imagine the amount of work to create that and to write? So he had to be disciplined. So it was like every Tuesday, you can have George from 11 to 1 to do interviews. So I was a great admirer of that discipline that took him to the craft. And he was great about doing, he knew if he's going to go to Omaha, he better do the radio station in Omaha.
Yes.
You know, he wasn't too big. He goes, "No, I don't need them." No, we would look at ticket counts and realize, you know what? Poughkeepsie is doing great. We can ignore them. Omaha can use a little help. Let's do a radio. Let's do that. And when he had a new book to hold up or a new HBO special or he was going to be in a new Bill and Ted movie, he would do press. He was proud of those efforts. And he wanted to make sure that book went to the New York Times bestseller list. And he wanted to make sure everyone knew he had a new special. So he was not above doing press, but really only wanted to do it, you know. And I had other clients, you know, somebody would do a magazine. "Hey, what's in your medicine cabinet?" You know, those kind of quirky little stories. And I had clients who care less about that. You know, I want to talk about my craft. And other clients that they wanted to do, you know, wanted to be in everything to keep their name out there. And there's something to be said for that. I don't negate it, but depending on the type of client, you know, like certain people don't tweet, you know, it's like, unless they have something major, and then certain people are tweeting what's in the refrigerator daily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have great admiration for George Carlin. I loved him as a boy, and as I grew older, his comedy evolved. And, it was one of the things on my bucket list to do a comedy set, because there's nothing scarier than do comedy, because, you know, it's like, oh my God, if you screw up, you're out there, you can hear the crickets. And so I had the opportunity to do a 4-minute comedy set at the Harvard Club of New York, and they laughed. So I could cross that one off my list. So, but I highly respect comedians. It's not that easy.
Yeah.
Well, they say the greatest fear is standing in front of people. Now combine that with the getting up in front of people and trying to make them laugh.
Yeah.
And you know, the danger is if people can't laugh the first time and then they go back the second time and they die. And a lot of them quit. The whole thing is you have to fail so many times
exactly
before you get good.
and handle the stress. Yeah.
And then Jeff, the transition comedian to actor and becoming the superstar. There's so many comedians that are always on stage that never got that opportunity, that sitcom or that big show that changed things.
Yeah. And that again was the wonderful thing about George. You know, people said, "Oh, you represent comedians." Like, I was limited to that. But the one thing about George, I was representing an author half the time, because during my reign, he did 3 New York Times best-selling books. He was in several movies, and we promoted a TV special as if it was a TV series. So the great part was he got to do everything, you know? And, you know, when you represent a sitcom star, hopefully you're representing the number one or two lead. You know, representing the fourth lead is very difficult, you know, because no one wants to talk to that person as much, unless it's a true ensemble like Friends and everyone is even willing. Yeah.
Wow.
And that's the thing, Dave, that is interesting with Jeff is just once you put George Carlin as one of your clients, it's easy to close once you've said you've represented a legend like that, right?
Oh, yeah. I was impressed.
Would you agree?
And he's been gone. I think he's been gone 11 years now. But it's still it's still a badge of honor. And I've gotten, I've worked with his estate off and on to this day on various projects. And his daughter donated her father's papers to a wonderful museum that's in Jamestown, New York, the home of Lucille Ball, called the National Comedy Center. And when she donated her papers about 4 years ago. The center before it had physically opened. And when they wanted to do a press release, she said to them, "The only person who should really be talking about my dad is Jeff Abraham." So I helped them do the announcement. We got some great press. And to this day, I now represent the Comedy Center because of that.
Wow. I bet some of those papers included napkins, right? Scratching out.
Absolutely. George wrote on things. He was always taught to write things down. So there were a lot of scraps of paper and a lot of baggies. In fact, we through our archivist at the center and George Carlin's archivist, we were able to take a scrap of paper and then watch and see it build. Oh, this scrap of paper, this underlying thought became this routine. Absolutely. It's fascinating. Yeah.
Wow.
Now, that's the excitement. So, Jeff, the final question we always have is Dave asks that caregiver question. He's a caregiving expert. And, Dave, you go ahead and ask the caregiving question to Jeff.
The caregiving question. Okay, well, you don't know anything about me, but you can see my background. I've had the opportunity to speak everywhere in 34 TV shows and on stages at Harvard and so on. And I'm just sharing my story because I was just a normal guy. I own a gas station, still do. And one day when we were going through the empty nest phase of our life, we had 3 daughters, raised them, got them out of the house, got them married off, each one twice. My wife complains about a headache she had for like 3 days, a headache of her life. She wanted me to call Dr. Kevorkian and put her out of her misery. Wow. She was kidding, of course. But that fourth day, we didn't have the opportunity. The ambulance came. It was too late. She had suffered a stroke, lost her speech, became paralyzed on one side. And in that moment, our life just turned upside down. Everything changed. Nothing would ever be the same again. But we grieved for a couple of years. Anytime you suffer loss, you grieve, you go through the process. And after a while, I needed to go to a support group to learn that if I didn't take care of me first, I couldn't take care of my wife. And so, like the airlines tell you, put your mask on first. Well, I started doing that. I started feeling selfish and guilty, but slowly but surely, my wife started coming around, being her old self again. Our love was rekindled. And now we travel the world just sharing our message to caregivers, how to stay alive. You know, don't let your loved one's illness or disease actually kill you. And now don't let the coronavirus kill you because it's even more stress for caregivers and so on. My question to you, Jeff, is has caregiving touched your life? Because I always say, just wait. You're either going to become one, you're going to need one. There's no escaping it.
The only thing I can say is Monday.
Sorry for the heavy.
Monday is the 1-year anniversary of my father's passing. But I was very fortunate that he had a stroke and died 2 weeks later.
Yeah, that's a blessing, believe it or not. Go on and on and on.
And not to be selfish, it's a strain on the family members to watch someone there, but trust me, he was doing worse than we were in that hospital bed.
Yeah, that's how I want to go, like that, boom.
So I'm not answering your question, but I had friends who, you know, watched their parents, you know, wilt away with Alzheimer's for 5 years. And my father was ill, I had a friend who lost his father and mother within 28 days of each other. And I said, wow. Luckily, my mom had died 10 years prior to my dad, you know. So the only thing I can say is enjoy the moments, you know. I kind of always thought dad would always be with us, you know. And he died he had a stroke on April 15th. On March 24th was my birthday, so about 5 weeks before his stroke, they were planning a birthday. We were going to have a get-together at my brother's house for my birthday, and one of my niece's birthday was around the same time. And I didn't know it. They had planned it in the last second, and I had made plans elsewhere. So they said, oh, I'll see you Sunday. I said, oh, I won't be there at my birthday party. And ironically, my dad was the last time he came up to visit, and I wasn't there. And it kind of sticks at the back of my head every moment, you know?
Yeah.
But no, I was a good son, and I visited him. I saw him, you know, 3 days before the stroke. But so my takeaway is this, you know, your parents aren't always going to be there. You should try to sit down with them and ask them questions and enjoy their moments with them with viruses. And, you know, you say during this virus, call friends you haven't spoken to or loved ones and say that, you know. It's a shame. As a scholar who's, you know, written a book and done all this research, I can tell you everything about, you know, Dick Shawn, who died on stage, his life. Yeah. And I may not know everything about my dad, because I never sat down and said, Dad, what was it like in the fifth grade? You know, right. and the terrible thing is, my dad was a pack rat. If you can see behind me in the Abraham Comedy Archive, about 5,000 albums, I picked up that habit. But he had every piece of paper. He had the mortgage from the house I was born in, and every receipt. And I really wish he was one of those persons. I'll get to it. We'll go through those later. And I really had wished we had pushed my dad to go through these papers and ask him about, you know, his high school yearbook. I looked at the family photos one more time. So
exactly.
Wow. So what I would say is, you know, it's not too late to call someone today. Spend time with your dad. I know we Zoom every dad now. He's probably on Facebook or Skyping or at least by the phone. And call in. My mom used to kid me every time, and when I used to get the caller, she would always say, you know, you have a mother, you know. You could call me.
The Jewish guilt, okay.
Exactly. And it kind of worked, and it was important. There's so many things I really wish I had done with my parents.
Yeah. I actually did that with my mother and my mother-in-law. We did a video. Well, tell me about your life. You know, I just turned the thing on and walked into the other room, and they're just talking and talking and talking. And,
all right.
You know, everybody talks about the unsung heroes in this pandemic, the hospital workers, the nurses, and so on. But nobody talks about the new caregivers that are coming on. New caregivers are being made as frequently as someone gets infected. So I got a website, caregiverdave.com. It's a membership website. So that's the support now, the online support to help you not only survive, but to thrive as a caregiver.
That's great. Okay. All right, Jeff, best place we can find info on you, Jeff, and stuff, to purchase the book and stuff. Where's the best place to go?
Our website is theshowwon'tgoon.com or Died on Stage, and that's where you will find it. It will be Amazon links to previous interviews. And it's great. And I love telling our story. You know, the book came out in September, but Bert has been capturing names of performers who died due to coronavirus. I mean, there's almost a sequel based on that.
Yeah. Wow.
Volume 2.
Yeah. But, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Take care, guys. Appreciate it. All right. Thanks
Neil.
All right. You're right. All right. Okay. You're listening to Neil Haley's show, and we'll be back in just a moment.